Understanding Cyber Threats in Today's World. The recent cyber hacking of Marriott's parent company, Starwood, is believed to be the biggest breach of customer data in history. But it follows a string of other big security breaches affecting millions of people each, including Equifax, Facebook, Target, and Ticketmaster. These incidents raise real questions for everyday people. How do we know if our information has been compromised? What can or should each of us do when we hear about these incidents? Is it too late to protect ourselves in the future? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Cybersecurity. We'll learn how these data breaches happen, what experts know about who's behind them, and how to think about protecting yourself. Also, why cybersecurity offers a great opportunity as a career. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. With every major security breach that hits the news, we all feel more vulnerable to having our information hacked. Is this just something we learn to accept? What actions can people take to protect themselves from cyber attacks? Joining me in the studio, Ingrid Olson. She is a security developer with GuidePoint Security. And Casey Dunham, founder and CEO of Circle 9, who consults on cybersecurity issues. We thank you both for joining us today. And as always, we want to hear from you in the audience. Were you one of the millions of people affected by the Marriott hack? Do you know? Do you have questions about passwords or credit card protection? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. And thank you both for being here today. I'm guessing, Ingrid, that every time something like the Marriott hack happens, that you are the most popular person at a dinner party, that everybody wants you to explain what happened, should I be afraid, and what is your general advice to people who come to you when there's a big news story like this?
Well, the sky isn't falling is the good news. This is sort of the landscape that we're in now, and now as over the past decade or so, there's increasing amounts of data that are online, and more transactions are done online. There's just more. It's just sort of the nature of the beast right now, and we're working to improve the security posture over time by
companies internally are trying to improve it. Banks are trying to improve it. The government's trying to improve it. But even with all of them working together, doesn't that open us up to some risk?
It does, absolutely. But there's risk in everything we do, right? So it's sort of a cost-benefit analysis. Am I not going to live my life? And am I going to stay at home, or am I going to go out and I'm going to participate? And you have to sort of make those decisions based on your values.
Yeah. So Scott, Casey, tell me how something like the Marriott hack happens, and in sort of real people terms, explain to a non cybersecurity expert, how did this happen?
Yeah. So one thing is good to keep in mind is that in a lot of organizations I've dealt with, no one wants this to happen. Everyone's trying to do the best job they can, but any medium to large size business, it has so many complex applications. They're all working together to do data processing, transaction processing, booking, and it's a really complex subject. And unfortunately, a lot of the applications that are highest risk are old ones that have been developed for years, that are using outdated technologies that is now an issue to keep updated. I don't know specifically, what the nature of the Marriott hack was, but from other ones that I've seen and other companies I've worked with, that's one of the biggest issues. So, that's an ongoing problem that a lot of organizations face, and there's really no one size fits all solution for that.
Does it happen that the companies that were sort of early adopters, the earlier companies that you could shop retail online, for example, or have a membership that, automatically updates, are those in sort of a convoluted way more at risk because they were using different older software in the beginning or systems?
When online retail first started, there were different problems. There are different threats and different risks out there than those threats and risks haven't changed, or they haven't gone away, but they're different today than they were. So earlier adopters, like some of the large corporations that we are all familiar with, they've kind of gone through a lot of this, and they have processes now that are more streamlined, and they can produce stuff faster, but also by nature of that, they can also produce it more securely. You know, they still have problems themselves, but they're able to respond to it because they have the budget and the manpower to deal with it, where, you know, a lot of medium-sized organizations and even some large ones aren't able to do that for various reasons.
Well, let's talk about the most recent big headline cybersecurity story, which was the Marriott or the Starwood security hack. A lot of people are saying now, and this is in the New York Times, and the Washington Post, and all the big media outlets, that U.S. officials believe that it's China. How do they know that this is China?
A lot of times the code that is executed will have a sort of signature to it. So they'll be able to analyze, it's almost like a thumbprint of some sort that you would be able to look back at and say, okay, this code is written in a similar way to this other code that we already know that China is doing. They also have a lot of monitoring that is going on so that when they, after an incident is reported, they have forensics that can go back and do incident response and I trace those trailheads back to the source sometimes, but it's not linear or straightforward. It's complicated.
Mm-hmm. So when we read this, though, that China is trying to, or let me put it this way, when we read that China may be the actor that's breaching the security of a major hotel chain, ought we assume that somebody like China or Russia or Iran is sort of maybe breached other organizations that we just don't know yet?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reality is that they probably have. And so it's a matter of being your own advocate and being careful about to whom you give your data and protecting yourself. Because security practices are constantly maturing, but the threats also are at the same time. And so it's fine. The risk is there and it's real, but it's manageable.
Well, you said be careful who you give your information to. I mean, my understanding is that in a lot of these cases, these were at foreign hotels where somebody gave a passport to a desk clerk because they were asked for it. I mean, that seems like a standard procedure. This was done even before there was such a thing as computers.
Yeah, well, it's the same argument for using Social Security numbers as identifiers. You know, we willingly give our Social Security number out all the time to people, and it's kind of a nature of how we're doing business today. You can't really not do that. You can't stop from having to give your passport to somebody. You can't, you know, when I worked in the restaurant industry many years ago, we had the same issue with people, you know, we don't think twice about handing our credit card off to a server who takes it off somewhere else. And we had an issue at one of the restaurants I worked at where people were just writing down card numbers. And, you know, they had the card so they could write the CVV numbers and all that down. And so that's a really low-tech way, but the same risk is still there. And so you can't stop from giving your passport off to, you know, a hotel that requires it, or, you know, your credit card. And I mean, you can't really function in society today without a credit card.
Yeah. And even like when you write a check, the number of your checking account is on that check that you're giving to any individual. So it's the same sort of thing. Like that is a real risk. And you have to pay attention to your bank account. You have to keep track of what's coming in, what's going out. And so in some ways, it's no different than that situation.
That's interesting. You said pay attention to your bank account, because that was going to be my next question. Other than when your credit card statements come in, whether on paper or, you know, if you look at them online, studying your credit card statements, studying your bank statements, is that the best thing, the best first line of defense one can be doing right now?
I think it's good hygiene, almost, you know, think of it like exercise. You know, you want to have habits of doing that. So that's a really good first sort of pass at doing it. In addition to that, the bank security they're a lot better at flagging transactions that look like they could be potentially insecure. And in addition to that, now banks are starting to come out with one-time credit card numbers that you can use for transactions if you want to do something on the internet, for example, to buy something. But yeah, monitoring and being vigilant. But
okay, so Casey, what other tips do you have?
For me, as a consumer myself, and to kind of like changes a little bit. It's like I honestly don't really worry about a lot of stuff. I use specific credit cards. I try and insulate myself, my checking account, from as many purchases as possible. So I don't use cash a lot. I mean, almost every transaction I do is with a credit card. And
you know, a credit card as opposed to a debit card?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. And the reason for that is, you know, depending on the bank you use, they have all these different policies and how they handle illegitimate transactions all kind of varies. And, you know, you'd have to look at your bank and talk to your bank about how they handle fraud, you know, what the process is. Because they might do it, but it might take weeks to get the money back. Whereas, you know, I have a credit card that I use, especially when traveling internationally, where they have a lot of protections built in and their app is top notch. And, you know, if I do a transaction, I get an email with a link on it that says, hey, if this wasn't you, click here. And I've had to do that a few times and they've handled that stuff like really well. And, you know, it's like using PayPal, for instance, for a lot of purchases when you can, because it will keep you from having the risk of giving your debit card number out or your checking account number out. But also PayPal has their own kind of built-in fraud resolution handling. So you could, you know, request a, you know, mark something as fraud and you didn't get a package or something, and it would, you know, also streamline that so you don't have to go through your bank necessarily.
Yeah, and I can think of a specific example is like if you go to the gas station and you only, some people don't have credit cards, but if you have a debit card, run it as credit.
Yes.
Don't run it as a debit card, because that's cash that will come straight out of your checking account versus having those credit card protections that are in place by the companies.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. Okay, that's great. So I had always thought no matter how, whether I hit debit or credit, it's just going to come out of my checking account. But there's a special layer if you hit credit card?
Yeah, there are protections in place that the credit card that a credit card transaction will give you.
Yeah, and it further complicates it because one of the big issues that I look at as a consumer is going around to gas stations and ATMs and using my card there. Mainly because, you know, one of the big issues that faces risk of that is what they people put sniffers on them, you know, hardware devices that will record your card. And if you're using your PIN along with that, they've also got that now. Whereas if it's just a credit card, they don't have that additional piece there. And with the chip pins, and if the terminals are working right, you should be using your PIN with the chip card. So I run my every transaction I can as credit as well. Whether it's a grocery store, gas station, anywhere, I always do that instead of using my PIN on my debit card.
Do you all believe that there are more of these security breaches happening now than there were a couple years ago, or that we're only now just finding out about how many there are?
I think that we're finding out about more than we were. A few years ago, there wasn't as much push for disclosure of the information, in my opinion. And I think that since it's now on more people's minds, where, you know, it's kind of coming to the forefront more often, but the breaches are also getting, you know, bigger. In the last few years and years before that, you know, more and more data is now coming up lost or breached. You know, more credit card numbers, more passport numbers, healthcare information. It's becoming more of a problem now, because especially now that everything is kind of interconnected even more than it was 5 years ago.
Yeah, I do see it trending upward, absolutely.
What are some of the reasons that these hackers are doing this? We understand, or at least I've read in the papers, that the reason that China allegedly hacked Marriott is they wanted these passport numbers, especially people who are sensitive government officials in the U.S., for China to be able to trace them. So a regular person who's staying at Marriott's on family vacations or for a regular business is probably not what China was looking to find out about. But what about the others, the Target, the Equifax, the I'm drawing a blank right now. But some of the other big hacks that have happened that are really sort of more consumer-driven companies, what are the hackers looking for? What are they going to do with that information?
Well, a lot of them are going to sell it to other people, like the credit card data especially. Some may use it to impersonate your identity. Blackmail is another reason. Well, sometimes people will hack into the systems to get information.
Yeah, so like with a lot of the consumer-focused ones, they're looking at just trying to get as many mass quantities as possible, so as many credit card numbers. And then what they can do is they'll either use them themselves for carrying out further malicious activity, whether it's using those card numbers to pay for server time or, you know, physical stuff in the real world that they need, or, you know, resell them off. And these large hacks like that, one misconception is that they're, you know, some hacker in their basement. And that's really not the case anymore. There's a really big part of organized crime that has taken part in these. So, you know, you think about that, you know, the kind of, you know, mafia moving into cybercrime, money laundering and all that. I mean, it's still there. It's just now different. And I don't know for sure, you know, if these breaches happened because of that or organized crime, or it was some person in their, you know, hanging out in their basement. But, you know, the activity is very different today. And there is just more, it's more coordinated and more organized than I think a lot of people realize.
You know, I want to go back to what you said earlier, Casey, because one of my credit card companies does the same thing whenever I make a purchase, notifies me of that purchase and lets me, you know, kind of double check it. And you said there have been few times that you have found you did not make a purchase and you notify your credit card. That has got to add up for the credit card companies. What kind of money are the credit card companies sort of eating worldwide for these charges that are not legitimate?
Oh, tens of millions of dollars. And it's not just the credit card companies. It's the businesses themselves. So you end up with situations like a credit card gets stolen. You have this people will use the credit card and make small a lot of the times they're just very small transactions that people will make. And you have a bunch of people with the cards going, making small transactions, buying something at a store with that credit card, which is fraudulent. They get that piece of thing and then they'll give that item to somebody else who will then go return it to the store. And then the store itself will actually lose money as well. So.
Yeah. And yeah, I look at it as just as another line of defense. But yeah, the small merchants are another ones that will also kind of get hit hard by some of these. If they don't take the transaction properly, then there's chances the credit card company will refund it. But the amount that some of the big financial institutions are paying in fraud, I don't have any exact numbers, but it's pretty high.
But the good news is that is giving them more incentive to have more secure practices. So if they invest in security up front, if they are going to make up for it on the back end. So their heart, like you see with, especially with banks, that they're, when we do assessments at GuidePoint, we do them across a whole bunch of different verticals, and the banks tend to be very, very secure relative to some of the other industries.
Well, that's great to know. The new credit cards have the chips. Are the chips more secure than the old-fashioned credit cards?
Ideally, yes, but the problem, especially here in the U.S., is that a lot of the merchants aren't using them properly. So, you know, when you go to a terminal and you put the chip in and it's like, oh, no, you have to slide your card. Well, that, you know, completely undoes some of the protections the chip might add to that. There's also, you know, depending on the credit card company who's issuing your card, there might be some different consumer risks to using that versus the PIN and debit card. So you really have to kind of look and see what the risk is to you. If you, let's say, for instance, do use your PIN with a chip, or if you don't use a chip, you know, is it the same, or are they going to say, okay, well, you didn't use your chip, so we're not going to be liable for this transaction?
So this is the fine print that no one
exactly
reads.
And also, though, I mean, there's so many more transactions now that are being made on the internet, so that you can't put your chip in a computer and have so that, and I don't know what the numbers are in terms of percentages of transactions online, but it's much bigger than before.
So
obviously,
the old advice for trying to figure out if you're going to do online buying, and I say old, you know, a couple of years ago, folks like you would advise, make sure that website says HTTPS, and that means secure as opposed to not secure. Is that enough anymore? I mean, how do you know that the retailer you're working with is got good security systems in place?
As a consumer, you really can't. And looking for that isn't really a surefire way, even a few years ago, to know, you know, what they're handling on the back end. But, you know, when you're using retailers like, you know, Amazon, Google, Facebook, you know, anything like that, I mean, you're pretty well off. And also, to further complicate that, you know, a lot of my stuff is done on mobile today, like iPhone. And it's really hard to even look at the URL to see where you're even at,
right?
You know, if you're doing browser-based kind of purchases like that.
And so what one thing that I recommend doing, and that I personally do myself, is if I see an advertisement from somebody that an organization I want to buy a product from, I'm not going to click on the link in the email. because it could be potentially from somebody who actually isn't that organization. And I will just go directly to the site because they'll have like maybe one character, one letter off of the site. So it'll be like, you know, Amazon.com instead of Amazon.com.
So if CVS sends you an email saying 25% off beauty exactly. products today, yep. you're not going to click on the link. Instead, you're going to go to CVS.com or go yep. to your local store.
Yep. And the same thing with making if I get a phone call from a bank or something, I'm going to call the number on the back of my card. I'm not going to call any numbers that they give me in an email, and I'm not going to call any numbers that they give me on an answering machine message.
Yeah. All Don't right. ever trust anyone that calls you if related to financial information.
That's good advice. We're going to go to a quick break. If you have questions about cybersecurity, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And InSource Renewables, committed to providing renewable energy solutions that support Maine's communities, workers, and the planet. InSourceRenewables.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ben Stiller about directing the Showtime series Escape at Dannemora, based on the true story of two inmates in a New York maximum security prison who escaped with the help of a woman who worked there. Patricia Arquette just won a Golden Globe for her performance. Stiller has also been playing Michael Cohen on Saturday Night Live. Join us.
Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public's podcast shortlist is now underway. The shortlist provides access to a wide range of Maine's most informative, interactive, and entertaining podcasts, from politics to craft beer and everything in between. This week's featured podcast episode of the week is The Lore Podcast, an episode called Anchored, which features two stories set in Casco Bay. Do you have or know a podcast created here in Maine that would be a great addition to the podcast shortlist? Send your suggestions to shortlist@mainepublic.org. The Maine Public Podcast Shortlist is at mainepublic.org. Click on Podcast Shortlist under our radio tab.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, cybersecurity and ways to protect yourself. Joining me, Casey Dunham, founder and CEO of Circle 9, and Ingrid Olson, a security developer with GuidePoint Security. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Bettina Tagle. She is Assistant Professor of Cyber and Computer and Information Science at the University of Maine, Augusta. Thanks for joining us, Bettina.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great to be online.
So you teach students about cybersecurity issues. How do you teach them about problems and threats that may not even exist yet or may not surface until the future?
Well, it's really about scenario-based. There are so many students that are already online and interactive and actually work in the community. So they ask questions and go over the problems, and then you just give them the resources and the answers. The other thing is we use interactive tools online, and we have a cybersecurity lab that we run scenarios through so they can get that real-world experience.
What do you feel are some of the most important things that the public needs to understand about cybersecurity?
It's where are you giving your information? It's protection of your information and understanding who you're giving it to, why you're giving it, and where it all is going to be located. And like I had heard before, kind of understand that fine print of how they're going to use that information, and then protect the devices that you're using and know how to use them.
I understand that there is going to be a growing need for people with cybersecurity expertise. How many students do you have up there at UMA? How many students going into this field, and how many more do you think are needed?
Well, we probably need a good 300,000. Right now we have over 250 in our cybersecurity program that go through the just beginning and then are soon to graduate, and they go through internships to learn that real-world experience. But there's such a shortage that really we need to have all the schools work together and being able to provide that degree that will help protect really the nation.
I'll ask you this and I'll ask our guests in the studio. Is there a certain kind of young person, a certain kind of person who makes a good cybersecurity student and sort of has that sixth sense of how to tackle these unfolding and rapidly changing issues?
I believe that in a way cybersecurity can be taught to anybody, but as far as a student that would really grasp is somebody that has good critical thinking skills and somebody that's really passionate about security itself, and then being able to recognize patterns.
Well, Bettina, thanks so much for joining us. That's Bettina Tagle, assistant professor at UMaine. Augusta, what would you all say? What makes somebody good at what you do?
I think part of it is having a mindset of how can I break this? Like what can I do to make this? Why isn't this going to work?
A puzzle solver.
A puzzle solver, yeah.
All right. Well, we'll go to Neil, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Neil. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to ask, I recently heard something on NPR earlier today that Congress is working on a privacy bill. I'm hoping this is similar to what they have in Europe, like I think it's called the Right to be Forgotten.
The GDPR.
And I'm just wondering what the guests have, if they could enlighten me a little bit further on that, or just talk about why it's taken so long for that to come into America. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that for whatever reason, we haven't really had the. For one, I mean, it takes a while to get anything through a political, arena, but. It's also, I don't think it's been in the forefront of our minds here in this country for as long as it has in some other countries. And I think it's a great thing. I think that, you know, trying to let these companies self-regulate themselves just isn't going to work. If there's no one saying, okay, you can't use data like this, you know, there's nothing stopping them from doing that. We see that with Facebook and a lot of the other big social networking sites. And, you know, unfortunately, I mean, you're giving these sites, you know, your information, you know, in terms of, instead of paying them for it. And people ask, well, okay, why won't they just come out with a subscription? Well, they won't, because your data is worth more than you're going to be willing to pay monthly or yearly for that service. And, you know, unless you don't use those, I mean, your data is going to go somewhere. And having something like the Right to be Forgotten is huge, because often when you're deleting your information from a site, it's not really being deleted. It's still there. And if that database ever gets breached or that information is sold, it could still be sold off even though you've asked, you know, the service to delete it.
Yeah, I think some of the laws in the U.S. that exist currently are different than in Europe in terms of like free speech rights. I think they're a little bit more limited in Europe than they are here. So there are you kind of go up against some.
Constitutional differences.
Yeah. Exactly.
So a related email from James, he asks, why is the U.S. so far behind in credit card technology? When we went to Iceland, we needed to use a PIN to purchase gas, etc. Also in Canada and Iceland, where we were paying for meals, a credit card reader was brought to the table. They did not take your credit card and wander off to a computer. I am seeing this happen more often in the U.S. with these little boxes, and they run your credit card right there at the table. But I don't think it's – I think it's either a matter of law or accepted practice in Europe in a way that it's not here yet.
Yeah, it's really cost. It comes down to, you know, the merchants have to buy the hardware to put in their store to accept these. And, you know, even the ones that do have, like I mentioned before, that they have the chip card reader, but they're not using them properly. So you put your chip card in and it asks you to swipe it still, which, you know, it shouldn't do. And, you know, I was just in Europe for 2 weeks and, you know, I have a specific card to use that has a chip and, you know, I don't have a problem there. But, you know, when I first started traveling more, you know, it was an issue because at the time I was using a local bank and I didn't have a chip. So I couldn't use my card almost anywhere. You know, it was a few years ago, but still, you know, there's a lot of merchants that don't have the hardware to do it. And until the credit card companies just stop allowing them to run transactions without that, I mean, there's not really a huge incentive for them to really spend the extra money buying it.
We'll go to Brian, who's calling from Waldoboro. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm, as I was saying, I'm the president of the Jojoba Company, and I'm also in charge of our cybersecurity here, and we do mostly e-commerce business. But the it was mentioned earlier about how much is this costing the credit card companies and the merchants that are experiencing this fraud. And actually what happens whenever we have a fraudulent charge, not only have we already shipped the product, because normally we don't find out about it until a day or two later, but then also the credit card processor that we use takes that money back out of our account. So they are not only are we losing the product, we're also losing the money, and they charge us a $25 chargeback fee. So I don't know, when it was mentioned earlier that they're losing tens of millions of dollars, I don't know that that's necessarily true, because they're just taking that back from the merchants themselves. But that also then gets put into the books and therefore gets passed on to the consumer ultimately. So really it's costing each one of us. I mean, all of this fraud is costing the consumers themselves at the end of the day.
Brian, I really appreciate you calling in. How often is this happening to your company? How often are you dealing with fraudulent transactions?
Well, fortunately for us, we've implemented a lot of policies and procedures, some of the things that you're talking about, that we don't have a lot. In fact, in the past year, I would say we've had two fraudulent transactions where we've actually shipped the product and we haven't caught it. Our credit card processor has an 800 number specifically for fraud. So you can call them up if you think a charge is fraudulent, and they'll quickly go through some steps to find out if you should ship that product or not. But there have been two occasions in the past 12 months that I can think of where we've, you know, shipped a small amount of product, and then a month or so later, I'll see on our bank statement that money was taken out of our account from the actual credit card processor, since they're taking that money back and charging us that $25 fee.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you this. What advice do you have for other small Maine businesses? I mean, it sounds like you're pretty good at spotting what might be a fraudulent charge. How do you tell that?
Well, there's actually, the credit card companies have some good resources for small businesses, and actually the U.S. government does as well, for cybersecurity and for transactions, that you can look those up, and they go in depth into the things that you should do. Really, the main thing is making sure that the address that is associated, or whatever address is being entered into your website or given over the phone, that actually matches the credit card billing address, and that the shipping address that you're shipping it to is the same as that billing address. That's one of the big things, is that if the billing address is in Texas and the shipping address is Jamaica, well, that's a red flag. And that's something that needs to be checked out before you ship. But I would check with the credit card companies and with the U.S. I believe it's the Small Business Administration that has resources for small businesses in relation to this.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of manpower, though, double checking. Over here, Ingrid, you're nodding. Anything to add?
No, I'm just listening and agreeing.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Brian, thanks for calling in, and thank you for those tips. I'm sure a lot of small business owners appreciate them. I'm going to go to John calling from Freeport. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. John from Freeport. One thing that I've noticed is that I'll get emails quite often, and it looks like it's a legitimate company sending me something, a promotional and so forth. And what I do is I just highlight in the email the address of who is sending it, and I'll see that it's a fictitious address, like it might be .uk or something else. So I just delete any of those. So I guess I would just caution people to kind of look at that. Say, for example, they're getting something from what they think is a legitimate store, and it wants to direct you somewhere. To be very careful. That's my two cents today.
Yeah, that's a great point. And people are even able to send emails like spoofing an email address that is a legitimate email address, and that so you think it's coming from the right email address, but then still redirecting you. And the same thing with the phone. Somebody in another country or out of state can make it look like you're getting a local call on your cell phone. So just being mindful of that is super important.
Yeah, don't trust your ability to identify whether an email, a link in an email, is legitimate or not. Especially with a lot of companies, they use providers, do mass mailings, so it might not even come from the company's website. You just never know. And there's even times where I look at something and I'm like, oh, that looks completely legitimate. But when you dig in further, it's a little bit more, murkier than that.
And you have an expert eye.
Exactly. And it is getting very complicated. But one surefire, way is, right off, if you're looking at something and you see spelling mistakes or the English isn't very good, then I would delete it.
Delete.
John, thank you so much. If you'd like to join the conversation about cybersecurity, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to all. An Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
President Trump says he may declare a national emergency over the border wall.
Needless to say, emergency powers are intended to be used for emergencies, not to settle political disputes or to shortcut the political process.
But the system leaves it entirely up to the president to decide what qualifies as an emergency. I'm Ari Shapiro, Presidential Power, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, even Donald Trump's fiercest foes recognize that the president remains very popular among Republican voters. But there remains a core group of conservatives who continue to reject Trump as the leader of their party or of the conservative movement. Join us for provocative discussions with Max Boot and Rick Wilson on the current status and the future of American conservatism on the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
Coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, dealing with cybersecurity, my guest Ingrid Olson with GuidePoint Security and Casey Dunham with Circle 9. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Casey, let's briefly talk about passwords. How do you approach passwords?
So for me, I don't really know any of my passwords. every site I use, I use a password manager. So I just randomly generate a password for each site, and it just stores it, and I just copy and paste it when I need to access that site. And that allows me, it enables me to use a different password for every site that's completely random, and two, not to have to really, write these down and remember them or anything like that. Because one of the risks here is that when we talk about these data breaches, if a company is not protecting the passwords properly, then an attacker, a malicious actor, can get those passwords. And what they'll do is, especially if they can match it up with an email address used at that company, they'll then try shopping that password around to other sites or services that the user might be using.
And seeing if you use the same password for different things.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, and I've heard too, if you're not comfortable with a password manager, you can make up things that, I love basketball. I love basketball games, and have it be ILBBG, or something like that.
One thing to keep in mind is that at this point, the length of the password makes more difference than the individual characters in it. And at this point, if your password isn't over 12 characters, then it's going to be still possibly to.
A long password is better.
Yeah, passphrases. So combining phrases maybe. But the problem with that is if you end up getting into some repetition where you use one format for one site and then you use the same one for another site. And that's really not a good way of doing it either. And if you can't use a password manager, and I know a lot of people say, I would suggest too, just write them down in a book, because the threat there isn't somebody breaking into my house to steal my notebook of passwords. That's not what you're trying to protect against. It's really you're trying to protect the event where somebody steals your password online through some means and then reuse the password elsewhere to try and access your account. So, worst case scenario, if you can't use a password manager for some reason, write it down in a book that, you keep in a locked desk drawer or something.
And I know, Ingrid, you want to make the point to keep your passwords in your will or someplace where if you're gone,
right,
you're
to have access your
accounts.
Yeah, your sort of your digital assets and what having a plan for who do you want to have access to which accounts and to be able to either keep a backup of your passwords in a lockbox in the bank is one thing, and I can provide you a list if you want to post later of like
Wonderful.
Steps you can take.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ingrid. Joining us on the line now, Senator Angus King. Senator King, thanks for joining us today.
My favorite password is I love Maine Calling, especially when it's hosted by Jennifer Rooks.
Oh, that's a great, and it's more than 12 letters,
it's
too.
It's a little long, but.
No, that's a great password.
But now we all know it. Never share your password. That's
one. Adding it to my list of potential passwords.
Well, I just invented that one, so I think I'm safe.
Good. Senator King, I know that you've really been focused on protecting energy grids from cyber attacks. What do you know that makes you worried about this?
I know a lot that I can't tell you, but let me just, and I've been listening to the program, and the focus you all have been on is terrific, and I think very useful. What I've been focused on down here is a different kind of cyber attack, which is a malicious actor, a nation state or ISIS or somebody like that, who attacks critical infrastructure. The energy grid is a perfect example. 3 or 4 years ago, the Russians essentially took down the energy grid of Ukraine, of the country Ukraine, and it was a kind of wake-up call of how vulnerable these systems are. Interestingly, one of the reasons the Ukrainian grid came back online rather quickly in a matter of hours was that it wasn't fully digitized, that it had some old analog switches and human intervention so that the attack wasn't as complete and successful. A fellow named Jim Risch, who's a colleague of mine, a Republican senator from Idaho, and I have a bill in which we barely missed getting passed in December. We're hoping to get it through in the next several weeks. But anyway, it mandates research on the issue of how do we build into complicated infrastructure like the grid and the financial system protections, and some of them may be sort of back to the future, older ways of doing things so that we're not subject to a catastrophic breach. And believe me, there are people that would very much like to have the capacity to do that.
And isn't it believed that already some bad actors do have the capacity to do that and just haven't done it because they're waiting?
Well, there has been public information to that effect. I can't confirm it, Jennifer, but let me just say there's plenty to worry about. And that's why a cyber attack of this nature, we're not talking about stealing emails here. We're talking about bringing down the electric grid or the financial system or the natural gas pipeline system where there would be injuries and deaths. So this is not an insignificant kind of concern. And here's the real problem that I've identified in working on this now for the past 5 or 6 years. There's no deterrent to another country doing this to us. In other words, they have no fear of retribution. If they drop a bomb on us, they know that we'll drop a bomb on them. But if they commit some kind of really aggressive cyber attack that could be disabling, we have no announced, if you will, a doctrine or a deterrent philosophy that they realize they'll pay a price for that. And that's something that a group of us down here have really been working aggressively on, and in fact, we've under statute, a commission has been formed to work on just that subject, which I and a couple of my colleagues are going to be on starting this month.
Senator King, Ingrid Olson, who's here in the studio with me, and I were talking over the break about the energy grids, and I'm going to see if I'm asking this question right. Ingrid, are you looking at using solar power as a way to sort of protect smaller parts of the energy grid? Go ahead, Ingrid.
Yeah, I guess I was interested in understanding, is there a solar solution part of building a more resilient system sort of on the table for the work you guys are doing?
Well, you've hit on my other pet subject, which is what's called distributed energy, which instead of the old model of a great big energy plant, electricity plant, in the middle of a state that serves every house, you have energy that's being generated all over the place, in some cases at the house itself. That is a more difficult target for a hacker. And it does make the grid more resilient and, in effect, self-healing. So that's definitely part of, I think, the future of energy generation is a more decentralized grid. Because if you think about it, if it's, you know, if it's one big plant, you knock out a breaker there or nearby, and you've knocked the whole system off. The classic example was in 1965 when something happened along the New York Canadian border, and the entire Northeast was shut down. And that was an accident, but that's a renewed possibility today. This is what keeps me awake, Jennifer. I believe the next Pearl Harbor will be cyber. And it is a very serious threat. And my concern, as I mentioned, is until we develop and make known a deterrent strategy, then our opponents look on us as a kind of cheap date that they can attack us without any consequences. And that's a dangerous place to be.
Well, Senator King, thank you so much, as always, for calling into Maine Calling today. That was United States Senator Angus King of Maine.
Glad to be with you, Jennifer, anytime.
We'll go to Barbara, who's calling from South Portland. Hi, Barbara, go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Boy, it was nice to listen to Senator King. He was very informative. My issue is that I ordered something online, which was shown on Facebook. I don't know if this has anything to do with what you're talking about, but I think it does. It may be relative. I bought it, and it's not working, and the company has no address, no telephone number. You can communicate with them through an email, and I asked them for their return policy. That's on there, but there's no address. The only return address I have is on the package, which may be a package service center, so I don't want to send it back there. Has anybody run into this kind of a cyber problem? I got it paid through PayPal, so I don't know if I can contact them or not.
And this is a site you found through Facebook to order it?
Yeah, it was on Facebook. It was showing this, it's a UFO, it was a cute thing. It was, you know, it sounded really cute, and I bought it for my grandson. I can't get it to work, and they're saying I don't know how to use it.
Well, oh, that's a
three
bummer.
Of us have tried to use it.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can speak to this specific issue, but in general, if you see a product that's advertised to you on Facebook, my recommendation would be to then go to Google and Google for it and find a more reputable organization to purchase it on if you're able to do that.
Yeah, and I want to note, Barbara, in a couple of weeks we're going to be doing a program on Facebook. So go ahead, Casey.
Yeah, in your particular case, what I would do, since you mentioned you paid it through PayPal, is that if it's a defective product and you know communicating with the seller hasn't resolved anything, then you can start the resolution through PayPal. And then at the end of the day, if PayPal still won't do anything, you can refute the charges to your bank, which I've done before as well for some issues, some various issues. And that might take a little bit longer, but that's definitely one way to go.
Great. Good advice. Thank you for your call, Barbara. An email from Linda. For many years, I've used my debit card for international currency when traveling abroad. It's convenient. It applies the current rate of conversion to the transaction and allows me to travel with less money on my person. However, it seems from your conversation that debit cards present greater risk than credit cards, risk that may be enhanced in certain countries. What do your guests suggest?
Well, generally, you can run the debit card as a credit card. So there should be an option to process it as credit.
Well, and so it depends. I mean, in the U.S., that's pretty common. In some European countries, you might be unable to do that. And I would just use a credit card. Insulate yourself, because that way, here's the issue. Like if I'm using my debit card, whether it's using a credit card or debit card, it's linked to my bank account. And if something happens to that while I'm traveling or gets lost, I may have some ability to correct that action through, a fraudulent phone call in my bank to talk about the fraud. But, you know, if somebody uses that and, you know, spends a lot of money in my bank account, then it's going to leave me, you know, potentially in a really bad situation. So I generally prefer to use all my international purchases on a credit card. That way, if I do need to use my other card, I can, but I just kind of insulate, add another layer of protection to my own financial situation there.
We have an email from Constantino, and you all are going to have to explain this question to me before you answer it. He says, could advanced malware and or virus take down the 30 or so points of traffic flow worldwide?
I think what he's referring to is you know, the internet at some point, you know, has wires that connect it to various other points. And I think that there are issues. There's in the internet backbone, and I can't speak too technically to this because it's a little bit outside my area of expertise, but with some of the routing, we have definitely seen issues where people have caused that routing that, you know, directs all that traffic at a lower layer to change where it's going. So I think it's totally possible that at some point, you know, something like that could happen. We haven't seen any complete outages, to my knowledge, like that based on an actual piece of malware. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's still pretty possible to that some of that stuff may happen. Now, all at the same time, that would be pretty difficult. But based on what I've read about and seen, that it, you know, it is definitely theoretically possible.
And let's wrap up, Ingrid, with some just summing up some of the advice today to either use a password manager or use different passwords for different accounts. Be sure and check your credit card statements and your bank statements monthly. Follow up on anything that's suspicious. And if you're a small business, reach out to your credit card companies and the Small Business Administration for information about.
Yeah, and two-factor authentication, I'm not sure that
we haven't talked about that.
So a lot of services, your email will give you the option of having so you provide your password, and in addition to that, they will send your cell phone a code that you then type into the website. So that way, if somebody for whatever reason, get your password, that they would be able to – they wouldn't be able – unless they had your phone as well, they wouldn't be able to access your email because they need both – they need two forms of authentication.
So if that's ever offered to you, say yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anything else? We've a couple seconds. Sounds good. Well, thank you both so much for being here. That was Ingrid Olson, a security developer with GuidePoint Security, and Casey Dunham, founder and CEO of Circle 9. He consults on cybersecurity issues. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.